I know who he is.
Well, if it goes to zero and it comes down.
This is not a math
class. You can just ignore it.
It just ignores the edges.
Yeah.
And then I can pick up the 2 points.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I can do it if I don't have the edges.
Yeah, include rigor.
Then you can just use a Cayley transformation.
Doesn't it exponential math?
Won't hit zero.
Yeah. Okay, so then it gives you an annulus. Maybe you guys can fight it out. Yeah, so let me start with a couple of announcements. So one is that the time and place for the do one of lectures. Will be on Monday, Tuesday, from 10 to 1 p.m. at 35 King. And I mean, I really encourage you to go there because even though I had to kind of develop all this heavy formalism and like what they're talking about, you will have a lot of kind of really sexy application. But today, I mean, yesterday we all could be sexy, but today will be perfect, will be sexy, and I really would like it.
Okay. And I guess also something that I wanted to say is that even though I'm the one doing the lecture here, and it seems that I'm doing all the work. In fact, I think what I wanted to say is to give a thanks to the tutors, that really without them, none of this would really work. I mean, and right now you, in some time you will realize how helpful they've been to you, and well, to me, to the lecturer. So to all the tutors, but especially the ones that have been helping this course, so Callum, Eleanor, and I guess Alex also has been helping. He's correcting your homework, that's the problem. So thanks a lot for that. And also, Catherine is not here yet, but I also want to thank her. She's been taking notes, as usual, I guess. And when I recover from this, I'll try to kind of go through them and merge them with my own notes so that we have a complete set of notes of the course that you might want to read later or and that we will use in the future. But it's amazing. I mean, she saved me a lot of work by actually typing in LaTeX most of the formulas. Okay, so now let's start. So today I'll do something that I haven't managed to do in the whole course, which is actually to finish early or on time. So I will not try to do very, very, very much, but at least I want to finish the course with something that I think is quite nice and important, which is to compute in one of the most important models that there is in a statistical mechanics, which is the Ising model, all the 3-point functions and the 4-point function of one of the simplest correlators. And with the tools that we will use today, you should be able, if you try it hard, say for a few days, you will be able to compute any correlation function in any minimal model using exactly what I'll do today. Any questions about yesterday before I start? Okay, very good. So let's go back to the two-dimensional Agent CFP. So in the last lecture, we described which is the two-dimensional conformal field theory that describes the critical behavior of the two-dimensional agent model. And I motivated by several ways, and we compared some basic quantities between the calculations performed by just using the lattice model and calculations done using. By the way, I thank you for your notes here, but for taking the notes. I will turn them eventually into something. I'll try to work on them. Yeah. And what we saw is that there were two interpretations. One, two descriptions of this Ising CFT. One, in terms of this algebraic construction that we went through of conformal field theories, starting from just basic principles of field theory without ever referring to Lagrangian, what we could call the some algebraic description of the minimal models. And we identified a particular one, the 4-3, to be the relevant one for the Ising model. And then we found that for this particular case, there is also a more conventional description of the conformal field theory in terms of two-dimensional Majorana fermions, okay, for which we can write down Lagrangians and so on. But again, this description is, unlike the case of the free poisson, is not totally trivial because we have to define these exotic-looking spin fields that create these branch cuts for antiperiodic fermions. But it's useful to go back and forth between one picture and the other. In this lecture, I will mainly emphasize how to compute the correlation functions using this description, because this is the one that, because this other one is not readily available for a random CFT. Usually you have to use bootstrap techniques that do not rely on having a Lagrangian to compute correlation functions. But in this particular case, for example, one of the correlation functions that will be very easy to compute in this framework, that will be maybe a bit harder to do here, would be to compute the four-point function of the energy operators. Okay, so I'll remind you what this thing is. So this is very easy to do in this language, because remember that these Majorana fermions were psi and psi bar. And in this language, the energy operator is just psi, psi bar. So that the exact four-point function of the energy operator is just obtained by doing free field contractions using free Majorana fermions in two dimensions. But in this lecture, the main goal will be to compute. But before telling you what I compute, let me remind you what the operators are. And what we saw by analyzing the CAC table of operators for the minimum model for values 4-3 and central charge 1/2, or also by looking at the free fermion description, that there are three primary operators. In the classification in terms of pairs of integers, we had the identity operator, which is the 1-1. We had the spin operator, which was the 1-2. And we had the energy operator, which was the 2-1. Okay? So this is the identity. This is the spin. And this is the energy. And yesterday we spent some time explaining why. What is the relation between these primaries and the basic variables of the lattice description of the two-dimensional Ising model? Okay? And what we explained was that this guy corresponds, these are two relevant operators which have a dimension h equals h bar. The identity has 0, this has 1/16, and this guy has 1/2. And this, so these operators are relevant. And what we saw is that deforming the conformal field theory by turning on this operator corresponded in the two-dimensionalizing model to introducing a magnetic field that would couple to the spin. And the turning on this relevant operator would change the temperature away from the critical temperature, okay? And therefore, you would get a non-critical theory. What we did is we, so now, in any conformal field theory, what do we want to do? What is the thing that we care about? What are the observables? And the observables are the correlation function. So just so that, to emphasize that this is what we, that this is the, what are the physical observables in a CFT? The observables are the correlation function. Of the operators in the CFT. And in this lecture so far, we've discussed mainly, and that's what in any case most usually discussed, are the local operators. So this primary. Okay. And essentially, in yesterday, we essentially computed from our knowledge of the scaling dimensions of the three primaries. We calculated the critical exponents. Of the Ising model. By computing the two-point function of the spin operator, which measures the correlations between the spins at the critical point. And they have this characteristic power law behavior. And it is one quarter because the position dependence of the point function is fixed in terms of the scaling weight, and we know the scaling weight, so that's what you get. And from here we concluded that the anomalous dimension of sigma is one quarter, okay? Which is large. One quarter is a large number. So this is not something that would be you can easily obtain by doing a perturbation theory. So this is an example in which we're going to get exact results by not using any perturbation theory. Okay? In perturbation theory, by definition, the anomalous dimension is something very small because it's proportional to the coupling constant. It's very small. And then we also looked at the energy operator. And from the knowledge that it has a scaling weight 1/2, we conclude that this has a power law 1/z². And from that, using its scaling relations, we extracted the critical exponent that tells you how the correlation length diverges as you approach the critical point. And we obtained that eta equals 1. And these two numbers coincide with the exact solution of the lattice model that in this case is available, okay? So these are the first things, but now we want to do more. We want to compute the other observables, the 3, 4, and so on. But in a way, if you know the three, and if you know, in a way, you can stop at the four-point function, because the other ones are kind of algebraically determined in terms of the lower one. So now what I want to do is to study the 3 and 4-point functions in the Ising model. Notice that actually computing these, the 3 and 4-point functions in the Ising model using the lattice approach is really, really very complicated. And here I'll be able to do it, hopefully, within the rest of the time of the lecture. So it's a very powerful way of extracting the critical behavior of CFTs to just go directly to the continuum theory that you get at the critical point, without forgetting about the short distance Hamiltonian that you started with. And the trick that we're going to use is the fact that these operators, both of these primaries, have null vectors at level 2. Okay? These guys have a dimension which, just to connect maybe with the language we used in earlier lectures, is this, are precisely of the form that, and the central charge is of exactly the right value, such that if you construct the descendant out of this primary, you get a level 2 null vector, okay? Which essentially allows us to solve the theory. And the level 2, if I remind you, was obtained by acting, by, it's given by this linear combination states, where H can be either, so you have two of them, one associated to H equals 1, 2, and one associated to H equals 2, 1. Okay? And the idea here is that you started with your primary state sigma, or A, or epsilon, and at level 2, so you jump 1 and 2, there is this state. Chi 1, 2, at level 2. Where here we go up, acting with the beta sort of generators, and the same thing here. You have a state, a null state at level 2. Like that. Okay. And the main tool that is used in this construction, in the solution of the minimal models, is to use the null decoupling equation. The fact that these guys are orthogonal to everyone, null vector decoupling equation. Which is a statement that to that state, by the operator state correspondence, we can associate a descendant operator, chi 1 to z, and chi 2 1 z, that has the property that the correlation function of chi z acting with acting on any string of operators vanishes. Okay? And then we use the fact that, and that yesterday's tutorial was very much about this, of how to rewrite chi of z in terms of a differential operator. And from here, we extracted a differential equation for the correlation functions of primaries. And let me write it one last time, which is that if here I have n operators located at positions zi, just representing that guy in terms of an operator, chi 1 2 or chi 2 1, using the stress tensor and doing some OPEs, we get this nice differential operator. Minus acting on the primary here, phi h of z times the string equals 0, where in this particular problem, this guy, phi of h of z, can be, depending on my choice of if I'm looking at the null vector associated to the spin operator or to the energy operator, phi h of z is the primary. So it can either be sigma of z if h, this H is h12, or it can be the energy operator if h is h21. Okay? So this is the basic equation from which everything will follow. Okay? And we study the consequences of this equation for the, well, we notice that for the two-prime function, namely when x is just one operator, say phi h1 or z1, we notice that this equation didn't teach us anything. Just told us that the form of the two-point function that was fixed by conformal symmetry is automatically satisfied if I act with this differential operator. So, you don't, well, at least it's consistent with that. And then we also saw that for the three-point function, where now this x contains two other primary operators, it can be whatever you want. It can be any of these guys. It can be the spin, the energy, whatever you like. What we saw is that the null vector decoupling equation was not sufficient to tell us the coefficient of the three-point function. So acting with the differential operator here didn't tell us the important part, which is the, well, it told us something very important, but not everything, which is this coefficient of the three-point function divided by the usual crap. So it told us, what it told us is what are the selection rules of that give you a non-vanishing three-point function. So it told us that if I tell you my choice of primary that has a null vector. So if I choose here sigma or epsilon, and here I choose sigma or epsilon, it tells you which operator I can insert here and get a non-zero correlator, but doesn't tell me what this number is. So this is kind of a selection rule of quantum numbers. It's not the value of the correlator. And doing this exercise, what we found is kind of the multiplication table for the fusion rules. So we obtain the fusion rules. The Ising model. And it has this nice multiplication table. So if you have two sigmas, the other guy has to either be the identity or the energy operator. If I take sigma and epsilon, the other guy has to be sigma. And if I take two epsilons, the only thing you can get is the identity. Okay? So just from these selection rules, it tells us that the non-zero three-point functions are. So remember that the three-point function, and now I can calculate by essentially computing the. So this is in the language of OPE, but in one of the exercises, we saw that if I give you the OPE, you have operator A times operator B equals the sum of operator C. I can relate the OPE coefficient to the three-point function, okay? So the non-zero three-point functions, the non-zero C's that I don't know yet and we have to compute are C sigma sigma times the identity and C sigma sigma epsilon from here. Well, from here you get the same. You have a C sigma sigma and here you get C epsilon, epsilon, then the identity. Okay. This guy is just directly related to the two-point function of sigma with sigma, right? This guy is just the and I already chose a normalization. So of course, the correlation functions depend on your normalization of the operators. But once you normalize the two-point function, everything else is completely fixed. So here I normalize the two-point function to be 1. I mean, the coefficient. Wait, I thought I wrote something. Maybe I didn't. Well, but OK. Let me write again. I thought I did. Oh, it's there. OK, yes. So here I normalize my two-point function to have coefficient 1. So this guy is just normalized to be 1, because it's directly related to the two-point function of sigma with sigma. And this guy also tells you the normalization of the two-point function of energy with energy, which is 1. And what remains is to calculate this, okay? Just a number, but we have to calculate this number. And the way I'm going to do it is by using information about the four-point function. And using the fact that the four-point function, you can take an OP of the four-point function, which essentially, that's one of the things I explained a couple of lectures ago. You can take the OP of the two OPs in the four-point function, where two operators collide pairwise, which essentially, from which you can read off the OPE coefficients, or equivalent to the three-point functions, and therefore extract this coefficient. And now we're going to see it very explicitly, how to do that. Okay, any questions so far? Because now we're going to do some. Fortunately for the edging model, the functions that appear in analyzing these are simple, are kind of elementary functions. In general, you get something a bit more exotic, but the ideas are totally the same. So we're not going to lose much by restricting to the edging model. So now what I want to do is now consider the four-point function of a spin of a, okay. First of all, in general, so how you would study the four-point function? You would use this equation where x is three arbitrary primaries. So we have this crazy differential operator. L hat is this thing, acting on phi h z, phi h1 z1, phi h2 z2, phi h3 z3 equals 0. Okay? Now, in principle, the way you would proceed is that you would plug in this guy. You have a n is 3, so you would act with that differential operator into this, and you would try to solve it. But this looks like a very complicated thing to do, because this looks like a partial differential equation, right? It has derivatives with respect to Zi, and has derivatives with respect to all the four points, okay? So this is complicated. A partial differential equations are complicated. But now what we can use is one of the things that we saw earlier in the course, which is the fact that correlation functions of primaries have to be invariant under global conformal transformation. Okay? Remember that we derived some conformal word identities, which is just the statement that four-point functions are invariant under the global conformal transformations. And there were essentially three equations that we obtained. One associated with translations, right, which told us that the sum from 1 to n of d to the zi, okay, this n is not the same as that n, it includes all of them. But okay, so n operators acting on the correlator vanishes. That's just a statement that the correlator is translational invariant. Then we had that it has to be scale invariant. So this is the differential operator that acts in spacetime by doing a scale transformation. It rescales all z by a factor, plus the quantum number associated to dilatations, like that. And then we had the special conformal, which gives you a differential equation where the vector field, notice that here the vector field is constant, here is linear, and here is quadratic. I don't know if there's a polynomial there or not. Okay, yes. Yeah, Euclid, who should be there, just by dimensional analysis. But I didn't know the coefficient. Okay? So these are things that any correlation function of any CFT, minimal model or not, has to satisfy. This is just the fact that you have a global conformal transformation. And now what you can do is use this equation, and I'm not going to do this in front of you because you would die, and more importantly, I would die in the process, but it's completely straightforward to do. What you can do is essentially replace the derivatives with respect to these three guys. I can replace DDZ1, DDZ2, and DDZ3. I can use these three equations. Here I have 4 points, right? So imagine I have 4 points here. I can replace the derivatives with respect to the 3 points. I can write it in terms of the derivative of the 4th point, okay? So that means I can turn this ugly-looking partial differential equation into an ordinary differential equation of one variable. Okay? Is the philosophy at least clear of what's going on? Clearly, you can relate. This gives you equations, a linear set of equations for derivatives with respect to z, z1, z2, and z3. So I'm just solving the derivatives of z1, z2, z3 in terms of the derivatives of z. Yes?
If
you have higher point functions, you get partial differential equations. Essentially, the one way of thinking about it is that the order of the differential equation is the same as the number of cross ratios that you can get. So at 4 points, you get one variable. There's one cross ratio. If you did the 5 points, you have two. More questions? So that's why I'm showing you the 4-point function and not the 17-point function. Because it would be. But in principle, it's a Lego. I'll tell you the Lego, and now you can put it together. And if you know how to use Mathematica, you put it into Mathematica. I don't know, but if you know how to use Mathematica, you could do it. But one of the things I said about CFTs that is not about CFT, that's not obvious, is that the consistency conditions of the CFT, it is sufficient to study. If the 4-point function is consistent and the torus amplitude that Eleonora will describe is consistent, you don't have to check any further consistency condition. It's a complete set of consistency conditions. That's not an obvious statement, but it's a true statement. Okay, so now I just solve this. I do some simple algebra, and then I can write the 4-point function of my CFT as an ordinary differential equation. So I define rho, just not to keep writing it, as 3 divided by 2h plus 1. This is kind of this coefficient of the null vector. And the differential equation that you get is a second order differential equation. Well, remember that z is the location of the null vector or of the corresponding primary. Plus, so you get the second order part, a first order part, and a zeroth order part. This looks a bit ugly. So here, h is either h12 or h21. So I'll write this equation once and for all, and I will never. So the reason I'm writing it is that if you want to study any other CFT other than the Ising, you just have to use the same equation. It's not that for every CFT you have to use a different equation. The only thing that you'll have to change is the fact that, of course, if you're talking about the equations that follow from a level 2 descendant, the only thing that you'll have to tune is the value of h that will depend on which CFT you're talking about and which primary you're talking about and the values of h. So this is h, sorry, let me write it like that. H plus h1 plus h2 minus h3 divided by z minus Z1, Z minus Z2, plus H plus H1 plus H3 minus H2, divided by Z minus Z1, Z minus Z3, H plus H2 plus H3 minus H1, Z minus Z2, Z minus Z3. So this whole sausage acting on phi H of Z, phi H1, Z1, phi H2, Z2, phi H3, Z3, equal 0. By the way, I should say that there is an absolutely analogous equation. There's the complex conjugate equation, okay? But it's exactly the same. I just have to take the complex conjugate, so I don't worry about it, okay? And now all that you have to do is solve the differential equation. And one, let me just give you a hint of how you can do that. One way to get some intuition about this is that remember that I have 4 points. So by a global conformal transformation, I can map 3 points that I want to 0, 1, and infinity. Right? I can send, by doing a global conformal transformation, I think you know how to do this very well right now. And then you get something that looks a bit more manageable. Okay, it doesn't matter. Let me not write it. The point is that by doing, so I'll leave it as an exercise, just write it down. And I guess the important thing I want to say is that by doing this, you get a differential equation. I should write it down. Let me not be lazy. Okay. Otherwise, you will not understand. I mean, the point I want to make will not be clear. Sorry, Katrin. But, acting on the correlator equals 0, okay? And now, fortunately, we're now this, I define here a G, a function of X. X is also a function of X bar. This G satisfies this equation and the corresponding complex conjugate equation, where now G, because I made this conformal transformation to map the points to these reference points, describes the correlation function of So this satisfies the differential equation. And now what you can show, you've seen in some form this differential equation during your career. It's related to what's called the hypergeometric differential equation, which is it's a differential equation in which we essentially know everything. So what I want to say is that the solution of this differential equation can be is what's called a hypergeometric differential equation. And this is an equation that we have completely explicit power series solution of this equation, actually around 3 points. So there are 3 special points in the complex plane. So you're doing a solving differential equation for X, and there are 3 special points. The 3 special points being 0, 1, and infinity. That's not surprising because this corresponds to the limit where I do an OPE, where this operator hits with 0. When I do the OPE, it means that X is close to 0. So there's a solution where the correlation function has an analytic power series in X, that corresponds to the limit where this guy collides with this. Do you remember that that's what corresponded to the S-channel expansion? There is another one where this guy, you do an OPE of this guy with this guy. And since this guy is close to this guy, what you have is an analytic power series solution. You have a series in, now not in X, but in 1 minus X, because X is close to 1. And then you can also do this was the T-channel. And you can also represent the same correlation function of as an analytic power series in 1 over X, where now you collide X, you do an OP of X with this operator, which is close to infinity. And therefore, now you get an analytic power series in 1 over X. Okay? And this is a characteristic property of hypergeometric equations. Notice that, just to give you a flavor, I mean, for example, near the origin, a hypergeometric differential equation, the solution of the hypergeometric differential equation is the hypergeometric series, which has an analytic power series like this. So these hypergeometric differential equations depend on three parameters, and it has a, maybe I should write how to do one more step and write this as a, let me tell you what the hypergeometric differential equation is. I heard that people wanted to see the correlator, so it's your fault I'm doing this. So the hypergeometric differential equation has three coefficients, A, B, and C. In our particular problem, A, B, and C are functions that are not hard to determine. I mean, they're very simple to determine, which are just functions of my input data, right, which are the conformal dimensions of my four primaries. And this guy, okay, there's an F here. Why did I put the Y there? I don't know, but there's an F. And this F has a, as you can check by just making a general power series, a series ansatz, applying it into here and solving the recursion relation, has this nice power series expansion around X equals 0, where these funny symbols are the what's called the Paul Meyer symbol, which is the gamma function of A plus N divided by gamma N, something like that. Okay? And the point that I want to emphasize that's important for our physical, to relate it to our discussions in earlier lectures, is that, which I already said in a way, but let me say it again because it's important, that F, and therefore the four-point function, has a convergent series expansion around 3 points, which, as I said, were 0, 1, and infinity. So this is a particular solution where you have a convergent power series around. You can check that this is actually has a finite radius of conversion. It has actually 1. The radius is 1. This. And as I already mentioned, so you have a single analytic function, okay, which is the solution of this differential equation. And depending, and which you can represent as a convergent power series if you choose to expand it around three particular points, 0, 1, and infinity, okay? But you have the solution everywhere. You have an analytic function with three independent convergent power series. And the reason it's useful to do this power series, first of all, that's how we're going to obtain the three-point function. But physically, what these three-point functions tell you is the three. So notice that in one of the lectures, that maybe it sounded a bit abstract, I said that you can compute the four-point function by doing the operator product expansion, by colliding operators next to each other. And when you do this power series expansion, you are studying the theory in a regime where one parameter is small, because the OPE is an expansion in some small parameter, which is essentially some distance. Okay. And this expansion precisely corresponds to the three possible OPEs that you can do. So here I have my operator 1, and here I have my operator H. This is the guy which is the primary that gave rise to the this differential equation. So for the Ising model, the operator that's sitting there can either be the spin or the energy operator. Then we have some operator here, 2 and 3. The location of this guy is x equals 0. This guy is at x. This guy is at 1. And this guy is at infinity, okay? And remember that now if I do the OPE of this guy with this guy, so I collide this guy with this guy, essentially what I'm getting is a power series expansion in x. Is this clear? Because remember that we had this formula that if I have O so here I have to put hk minus h1, phi minus h tilde, phi hk, evaluated at tilde, plus descendant, okay? So here I'm doing a power series expansion where the thing that's small is the distance between the two guys that I made the opinion on. So in this channel, what I'm getting is a power series expansion in x, right? Because x minus 0 is x, okay? So that's the, and this is what we call the S channel. I will not succeed. Yes? Yeah.
So from that diagram, it also looks like you're doing an OP between operators 2 and 3.
Between what? 2 and 3, yeah?
2 and 3, which are at 1 at infinity. So there the distance is not very small.
Yes.
But that OP still converges.
Yes, 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 yes. Okay, so around in the S channel, we can expand the exact solution of the differential equation. So it's a power series in X, N. In this channel, you can get the power series expansion in Y minus X, N. I'm not writing the coefficients. In the D channel, that's the reason why you get this very generic, the supergeometric differential equation has this mathematical property that has this three series expansion, and the physical interpretation is precisely this, that you're doing three different expansions of the same object. There's a unique correlation function that has three different power series representations around three different points. So now what we want to do is do this explicitly for the first spin correlator in the Ising model, where actually what we like is that because of the particular values of A, B, and C here, the hypergeometric differential equation would be an elementary, would give rise to an elementary function, no fancy hypergeometric equation. Well, it's a hypergeometric equation, but the solution is elementary. So what I want to do is compute the four-point function of spins in the Ising model. And now we know how to write down the most general form of this. We know that we use conformal symmetry to constrain the form of the four-point function. There was a piece which I can write like this. So there's one piece which is not that interesting, but that's there. I could have mapped my points to 0, 1, and infinity, and this thing wouldn't appear. But in the the tech book, they keep it, but I don't want to confuse you. I put them back. But this is the kind of thing that you can eliminate by pushing the points, this 0, 1, and infinity. That's, okay, let me just follow what the note says. And then here I have a function of x and x bar. Remember that I said the four-point function is up to some kind of trivial factor that depends on the dimension. It's a function of a single cross ratio, where x is the cross ratio 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 3, 2, 4. And now what I do is apply this general formula for the specific values of the dimension. So all these guys now all have dimension 116. So just like these values here. And in this case, the differential equation that you get for f, so we're trying to determine f, is x 1 minus x. Is x squared plus 1 half 1 minus x dx plus 1/16 f of x bar. And by the way, always this is the complex conjugate equation. And actually, in this case, you can check that the following elementary function, that is a second order differential equation, it has two solutions. And the two solutions are very simple. So it's f1 of x is 1 plus 1 minus x. But it's pretty elementary. Square root of the square root is like that. And so these are the two solutions to the differential equation. And which has the property, and we want to study, well, mostly we'll study near x equals 0, but we want to study these solutions expanded around different points, in particular around x equals 0. So around x equals 0, and we keep this number because we will need that to normalize the three-point function. And now if you just expand this around x close to 0, now you get root x or root 2, 1 plus something which is order x. Okay, this means just higher order in x is smaller. And so just from this knowledge, what this tells us is that we can write down the four-point function. Because it tells us that g is up to this crappy factor. So now I have a second order differential equation that acts on my correlator, and I have an equation for the holomorphic and dihomomorphic sector. So the most general solution is a solution, a sum over the two possible independent solutions, times some coefficients, aij, constant coefficients, times f I of x, f j. Yes. This equation is the most general solution to the four-point function, okay? Where this f now is super explicit function of x. But we're not yet done because the correlation function is not an arbitrary choice of coefficients. We have to fix what the coefficients is, and now we have to use some physical requirement. And I don't know how much you tell me about this, but let me tell you a little bit about this. It's related to So one physical requirement that has to input on the final form of the correlator is that it is single valued. It's a single valued function of x. And that tells us which linear combination of solutions here we have to keep. Notice that neither f nor f bar are single valued. Yes?
Are you summing over j as well?
Yes.
Sorry. And is that a function of x bar? Like, are you just doing the analog to the hand?
It's exactly the same function. We would have been x by x bar, right? Okay. Yeah, maybe I think this would be the same, right? It's a complex quantity function.
Okay. So you're just varying the entire function.
Yeah. Okay. That's what. So now what we have to demand is that if the physical requirement, this correlator should be single valued as a function of x, even though neither of these functions are single valued. Okay. So what we have to do is simple, and I'll just sketch how you do it. If you want to study how these f's, like the two basic solutions. By the way, these are very closely related, if you remember. And I don't want to overemphasize that point, but these are related to what we were calling the conformal blocks. Remember that we said it's a three-point function, and the four-point function could be written as essentially some structure constants times some function times its complex conjugate, and these guys were the conformal blocks. These guys are the conformal blocks. And one important property that conformal blocks have is that they are not single-valued functions of x. They have what I call monodromy, so it means that if you take x and you go around some circle, you can pick up phases and so on. And these phases are very important to determine because we want the complete correlator f and f bar is single bar. So let's see, how much should I tell you about this? So notice that let's evaluate essentially what you want to do is complete what I call the monodromy. The monodromies of this function fi. Okay. So essentially, from our knowledge of the power series expansion of f1 and f2, that's why I wrote it here, now we can ask what happens if I take my function, I go around the origin. So I have here the origin. I want to ask what happens if I move fi around the origin. Do I come back to the same function or not? But something that just know from general considerations of differential equations is that no matter what happens, you have to come back to a linear combination of the original function because you have a basis of solution, which is f1 and f2. So by going around the circle, you may not come back to the same function, but it has to be a linear combination of the original function. Okay? Because it is the basis of solution for the differential equation. So now, if you just do the monodromy around the origin, so if I let x, if I let the function not at x, but x to 2 pi I, which is just the statement that you go around this circle, notice that f1 comes back to itself, because this guy is now analytic in x, and x to the 2 pi I is the same as x. But here you don't come back to itself because the square root of x picks up a minus sign when I go around the contour. Because the square root of e to the 2 pi I is minus 1. So that means that, and I can write a matrix if you want, even though this is the diagonal matrix in this case. I said that here you come back to yourself. So, well, here you pick a minus sign. Okay? So this is the monodromy around x equals 0. Now I want to study the monodromy around x equals 1. And you can do that easily by just writing these functions in a way that have a nice analytic power series expansion around x equals 1. So you write, first of all, you can easily show that the solution, a basic solution is near x equals 1. So I have two solutions there. I can be either 1 or 2, okay? And take this form. Where plus is for 1 and minus is for 2. And I can write this as a linear combination of the basic solution at x equals 0, by the same logic before. So this is the same as f1 of x plus or minus f2 of x. Okay, maybe, okay, maybe I don't know why I tell you much about this, but the other point is that I expand f one two of x near x equals 1. Okay, which is the other interesting point. What you get is 1 plus minus 1 minus x plus higher order, okay? So that means now that if I do a monodromy, if I see how my basis of solution changes as I encircle f, but now around 1. So that means that I take 1 minus x, and I multiply it by e to the 2 pi I, okay? You find the analog monodromy matrix. It tells you that the monodromy, so this guy we call a matrix omega 0. This is the monodromy matrix of these functions at the origin. Then we have the monodromy matrices of these functions around 1. But notice now that if I do this, essentially f1 and f2 get exchanged. Because if I do this transformation here, the function that had a plus becomes a minus, and the one that had a minus becomes a plus. So that means now that the monodromy matrix in this case is off diagonal. And it's essentially 1, 1, 0. And now you can do, and that I will maybe leave for you to do, it's completely straightforward, to do a similar analysis. When you do a monodromy near infinity, the monodromy infinity is not really independent, but anyway. Sorry.
That's not good, right? Should leave this here. Okay, let me just write it here. And then the monodromy around infinity, which you can compute in exactly the same way, just take this completely explicit function and expand it around x equals infinity, and then around infinity go around 2 pi I, and you'll get also off-diagonal matrix like that. Okay, no. So, oops. Let me do this. And now this is sufficient. I mean, the reason I went through all this song and dance is that now I know what are the monodromies that this function f satisfies as I go around the three. There are only three points in which this function has monodromies. These are the singular points. If you go around any other point, you don't get any monodromy. And the fact that I know the monodromy around these three points completely determines up to an overall constant, as we will see that we will fix later, what is this Aij. So it tells us what is the force spin correlator in the edging model, completely explicitly. So using this explicit, and just do it, it's a simple exercise, I'm not going to do it in front of you, just take the determine essentially the Aijs that have the property that if you do this, that are invariant under this particular monodromy. And what you find is that it has to be diagonal. It means that G is a constant A that we still have to fix, it's an overall constant, times this annoying factor. times f1 of x mod f1 of x squared plus mod f2 squared of x, where f is that function. So this is, by doing not very much, we've computed exactly the four-point spin, the first spin correlation function in the Isaac model. And lo and behold, it agrees with a very hard computation that people had done using the lattice description. Okay? Notice that I hope it's clear that what have I done uses some particular features of the Isaac model, but could be done for any minimal model. You just have to change what these H's are, and of course the differential equation will be slightly different. But it will have the same generic properties. It will be a hypergeometric equation. It will have three singular points. You have monodromies around 3 points, 0, 1 at infinity. And by computing what these monodromies are, which is something that that is not hard to do, you can completely determine the four-point function. I think someone has a question. Yes?
These omega matrices look like poly matrices, or is that just
a galaxy? It's not an accident that if you multiply the three of them together, you get one, which is a deep property of polynomial. But it's not, I don't think there's any direct relation. Okay, and now one interpretation that you can give, so you might ask, why am I getting here two, the sum of two terms? And I want to tie that to our information about the fusion rules, which I may have erased, unfortunately. Oh, no. Oh, yes, I erased. Okay. So bad. Oh, no, it's there. Okay. So now I want to give an interpretation of how you should think of each of the Fs that appear there. So the way you should think about it is that, imagine now I think of this as an expansion around x equals 0. So what I'm doing is I'm colliding sigma with sigma, sigma, sigma. So essentially the question is, what are the states that can appear here? Okay? And that's what the fusion rules tell us. So the fusion rules tell us that I can either get the identity, and all, of course, and all of its descendants, or I can get the energy operator. So what this tells us is that, and I don't remember which one is which, that's easy to determine by looking at the behavior near x equals 0, what is the phase. Because remember, in the OPE, when you multiply two operators together, you get a third one. And the power of the exponent is given by the dimension of the guy that you get minus the dimension of the two guys that you collided. Okay? So by analyzing these functions near x equals 0, you will know whether you're getting this contribution or this contribution. But essentially what I want to say is that these two functions are in one-to-one correspondence with what you would obtain if you calculated the four-point function, not by using the differential equation, but by using the OPE, where you would collide sigma with sigma, and you can either get one or you can get epsilon. And essentially this function x is the contribution of to calculating the correlation function in this way that appears from summing over all the descendants that appear here in the intermediate channel. Remember that we said that when you do the OPE, you multiply two primaries, you get another primary, plus all of its descendants. And this function is a very elegant way of resumming the contribution of all the descendants. Okay? Good. Okay, I want to finish in time, but that's nice. Because now, I'll finish soon. I just want to do a couple of quick things. I promised that I wanted to get for you a C sigma sigma epsilon, and I'll sketch you how you do it. I'll tell you the idea, and you can finish up the details. I mean, the hard part is done. Now it's just downhill. Okay, so let's see. I can erase. So now how am I going to get the three-point function? Is to now think of computing exactly this correlation function using DOP, as I was saying here. So we already know from the fusion rules that DOP has this form. So sigma Z1, Z1 bar, sigma Z2, Z2 bar equals 1 over Z12 to the 1/8, Z12 bar to the 1/8 times the identity, okay? That's the first OPE. Why do I get 1/8? Because, or minus 1/8? Because minus 1/8 is 0 minus 1/16 minus 1/16, okay? And this is fixed by dimensional analysis. And now I can also get epsilon, and the set dependence again is fixed. But now here's where you get this OPE coefficient. Remember that we said when you multiply two operators together, OI, OJ, you get CIJK, OK. Here I get 1 because we had already normalized C sigma sigma 1 to be 1 because we normalized the two-point function of the spin operator to be 1, OK? And here you get now a different power, 3/8. Sorry, this is not mod, 3/8. Plus, of course, the descendants. Here I only wrote the primaries, but now you have to use the descendants. You just act with L minus N. But this will not be important for determining C or A, actually. And now this 3/8 is nothing but the dimension of, oh, I forgot to write something important. This is times epsilon, right? And 3/8 is nothing but, hopefully, 1/2, the dimension of this minus twice the dimension of the spin. Okay, hopefully this is true. And now what I want to do is a study on the one hand, or calculate on the one hand this four-point function by doing the OPE around x equals 0. So I'm doing the OPE where 1 and 2 collide. So let me compute it this way. The four-point function. And the good thing is that in order to extract this coefficient, it's sufficient to study the correlator near one point. So just using this, what you get from here, essentially, if you do the OPE, OK, let me write it. You get one quarter, sorry. Plus, okay, so how did I get this? Can someone tell me how I got this? Plus, of course, plus higher orders in Z12. I'm doing an OPE as Z goes to Z1 collides with Z2, okay? So the way I got this is I use this OPE formula twice. So I have four sigmas. First, I collided this guy with this guy. And here, roughly speaking, I get, forget about the factors, 1 plus epsilon. And here I get 1 plus epsilon, okay? So I reduce the four-point function now to a two-point function. And now I use the fact that the two-point function, well, this guy essentially is the two-point function of the identity times the identity, okay? So this guy comes from the two-point function of the identity times the identity. The cross terms vanish because the expectation value of any primary that's not the identity vanishes. I get epsilon times the identity is epsilon, and that vanishes. And this guy is just the two-point function of epsilon with epsilon. And you get this funny factor of two here, because remember that epsilon z, epsilon zero, is 1/z². Okay. And now that what you want to do is to compare this with the exact analytic formula that we obtained using the null vector decoupling equation. So what you do here is expand. You want to expand G, which is the four-point function, to in small x. Where x is a cross ratio. And that, okay, that I will not do in front of you because that's really very simple. And essentially by comparing, and now you compare what you get from here and what you get from here. They're the same thing. I just computed the same object in two different ways. And I'm just trying to decide how much I should show you. Essentially, this guy, okay, if you do the power series expansion of this guy, what you get is something like 2, 1 plus the square root of x, x bar divided by 4. And now what you do, and just do it, I mean, compare first the leading term. Look at the leading term. And the leading term you should compare with, oh, by the way, and there is a factor of, the thing that's important, there is a factor of A that we want to determine, right? So it's 2A times something or other. And what you do is first you compare the leading order term here, which has exactly the same behavior as this leading term here. So this tells you that 2A equals 1. So we have fixed completely. Yes.
Everyone squared?
Oh, okay, this was everyone.
Oh, that's okay. Okay, sorry.
So, given that we have normalized the two-point function of the spins to be 1, this determines completely the of the element. Completely determines the overall normalization of the four-point function. And now, by comparing the next leading order here, which you can now convince yourself has exactly the same power law dependence as you have here, you can extract the coefficients sigma x epsilon. So, and you find the sigma epsilon, which is the three-point function that we wanted to determine. And then what you get is that c sigma squared has 2 equals 1/4. So by doing this exercise and then thinking about the correlator as being obtained from the OPE, which essentially determines the three-point function. Well, now we have completely solved for the three-point and four-point function, at least of spins, in the engine model. And now in principle, and this will be a good exercise if you get bored during the Christmas break, set out, but something that would be that you can do now is use exactly the same ideas that I used here to compute the other interesting, or there are many others, but that's kind of the obvious other four-point function would be the four-point function of the energy operator. And here you can do it in two ways. One, which is very, very similar to the way I did it here. You write the differential equation. Now instead of using H12, you have H21. Instead of 1/16, you have 1/2, so it will change some numbers around, not very dramatically. So you can use the differential equation method. And in this case, we're lucky that it's very easy to compute the same thing by realizing that the energy operator we discussed yesterday can be realized as in terms of the free fermion theory. So you can now calculate this. So let me just write the answer. By doing weak contraction, you have free fields. Instead of boson fermions, you have to be careful about minus signs when you commute things around. But from here, you just do weak contractions of the four sides and four side bars, and you get this nice
notice that the correlation function of psi and psi bar is zero, so I can move all the holomorphic psi to one side and the anthropomorphic psi to the other. And this term, for example, is just the weak contraction of the Hadamard fermions. 1, 2, 3, 4. And this guy, for example, is the contraction. Remember, I said the propagator. Did I say that? I don't know. But I think the dimensionality tells you that the propagator of psi with psi is 1 over z, because psi has dimension 1/2. So the propagator has to have 1 over x, 1 over z, times twice the dimension. And this particular combination is the contraction of 3, 4, and the contraction of 1, 2. And these are the two other possible contractions. And, well, I'll leave it as an exercise to show that, in fact, if you do it this way, or using the differential equation way, you, of course, get the exactly the same result. And this, essentially, is the end of the course. Now, I think you have, hopefully, at least a glimpse of what are the basic tools that go into studying the observable conformal field, which are the correlation function. I gave you some concrete examples in case of the Eddington models that now you could try to generalize to others. The Eddington model is not the only model in the universe. There are many other ones. And I guess let me just finish by thanking you again, and good luck in the future. Thank you.